Welcome to Rice Pudding Poetry, now in its fourth year at Rice Public Library in Kittery, Maine. Our special guests are former Maine Poet Laureate Wesley McNair, studio musician and composer Kent Allen, and community readers Judith Castle, David Frainer, Rebecca Hennessy, Patrick Healy, and Jody Hetherington. My name is Kimberly Green, and I'm grateful to host this gathering of poets and poetry lovers. Together, we create the bit of magic that comes of warm friendship, music, a little mystery, and poetry. In the time of the coronavirus pandemic, we're cooking up this batch of rice pudding in a different kitchen. Instead of gathering in the Victorian-era Roberts Room at Rice Library, we're recording this show from our homes throughout Maine and New Hampshire using various devices, cables, and waves to reach you. Because you're the crucial ingredient. And we're so glad you're listening. Our show kicks off with Pussy Hat, our theme song, composed by Kent Allen and Joyce Anderson, and here performed in full by Kent. That was Pussy Hat, performed by Kent Allen. We're so glad to have Kent with us. You'll be hearing more of his beautiful music in a moment. But now I want to tell you a little bit about our featured poet, Wesley McNair. The poet Philip Levine describes him as one of the great storytellers of contemporary poetry. We know him as a poet laureate of our great state of Maine. And in that capacity, Wes's Poetry Express project brought him to Rice Library 5 years ago. The experience we had with him sharing Maine poetry served as a model for what has since become rice pudding. Wes has been the recipient of grants and fellowships from the Fulbright, Guggenheim, and Rockefeller Foundations. 2 NEA grants in creative writing, an Emmy Award, and a Penn New England Award for Literary Excellence in Poetry. His newest book of poems, his 10th, is called Dwellers in the House of the Lord, published by David R. Godin. We always ask our special guests to select a theme for our shows. Themes provide a sort of frame for our listening. Wes has selected the theme of reconciliation, a word that calls to mind all our experiences of loss, confusion, disappointment, and betrayal, hurts that can perhaps heal in time through various adjustments and attunements of the heart. Wes will tell you a bit more about himself and his new book, Dwellers in the House of the Lord, after Kent's version of the African-American spiritual Down by the Riverside. Here's Kent.
Hi, this is Wes McNair, and I want to begin this brief reading of mine by thanking my friend and sister poet, Kimberly Cloutier Green, and Rice Library, which happens to be one of my favorite libraries in Maine. Maybe some of you remember that wonderful Poetry Express event that we had, I was going to say a little while back, but maybe it's a few years back, still vivid in my mind as one of the very best events in the Poetry Express series. And while I'm thanking people, I want to thank everybody who helped Kimberly with this event. And all the poets I'm sharing our, non-existent stage with, including Kent Allen, an exquisite guitarist, a credit to all guitarists everywhere. And in case you didn't know, way back, my high school student in New Hampshire. As you know, the theme I've chosen for us readers is reconciliation. And that's because the theme is so important in the book I want to read four or five poems from right now, which is called Dwellers in the House of the Lord. And it's just out this month from my publisher, David Godin. Dwellers in the House of the Lord is an unusual book for me in that it contains just one poem, a long narrative poem, and the poem has two stories in it that sort of bump up against each other, setting off sparks. Actually, they weren't stories at all at the beginning, back in 2016, because they began as worries that sometimes got me up in the middle of the night. And one of the worries was about my younger sister, Amy. I got the news that Amy had Pick's disease, which is a rare and fast-moving form of dementia. It tends to strike younger people. She was in her 50s when she was afflicted. So I worried about that, and I worried about all the other trouble she'd had in her life, especially with my brother-in-law, Mike, who owned a gun shop in rural Virginia and was full of anger. And yet the more I thought about my sister, the more I realized that her life was not all sad, because she had this loving spirit in spite of her conflicts, which led her to a wonderful reconciliation in her family in the end. So I wanted to pay tribute to her by writing the story of how that happened. And then there was this other worry that kept me up in the middle of the night, and that was Donald Trump's rise to power in the White House through his campaign of 2016. And that became the second story in my book. Not a story of love, but of fear. I'm sure you'll recall the fear of immigrants with which Trump began his campaign and all the fear baiting afterward. You may also recall that Trump told Bob Woodward in an interview in the White House that fear was his most important political weapon. So I thought if I could intersect my two stories, the small, intimate family story about reconciliation and the big national story about fear and anger and division, I might not only be able to honor my sister, but help people to think about our politics in a different way, which is poetry's way. I mentioned immigrants. There are immigrants in my family story, too, but they're not villains in some made-for-TV drama intended to scare people. These are real-life refugees from my family, probably like the ones in your family, who came to this country with an American dream of a new home where they could become themselves. Heroes of a sort, really. But I have a limited time here, so let me go directly to the core of my family story, which is the trouble in Amy's marriage to Mike. So here's section 6 in part 1. In the years after she married, Amy had Sophia, named after Mike's mother, then Lena, giving birth also to a love and hope that went deeper than the fear she felt for herself, though now she was afraid for her girls. Each day as they grew up, she lifted the invisible wet finger of her worry, testing for currents of inclement weather inside her house. "Don't bother your father," is what I say on the bad days, she tells me on the phone. "He's never hit anybody," she adds to comfort me. "I don't think he ever would." In the photo Amy mailed of her yellow and orange beech tree in the fall, I see for the first time the house in Abner, where she started again. Over one of its two front doors, a sign says, "Guns." I continue now with two poems from section 7. I mention poems, not to confuse you. There is one long narrative poem in this book, as I say, but it consists of smaller poems, like these two I want to read to you, smaller poems that tell the story one by one. And so, once again, section 7. This is my favorite tree. It bears leaves all year round, Amy wrote on the back of the picture she sent, meaning I understood how the beautiful leaves flung high above the house had nothing to do with the troubles inside it. Like Lena's drawings of birds, which sometimes made her cry, she told me later in a phone call. They were so hopeful. But on the day she called about the church she and Lena and Sophia had found, Mike now busy behind the kitchen door in his gun shop, it was she who was hopeful. The bright tones of her voice still in my mind. It wasn't strict and plain like Michael's church, she said. It was made from somebody's home, with a funny tin hat built onto the front of it. And when we went inside, it felt mismatched and comfortable like a home. The worship room, you could see, used to be two rooms, she said. And there were curtains on the windows beside pictures of Jesus and the heart of Jesus with a key in it, and rows of mixed-up wooden chairs and different colored plastic chairs. But what really struck my sister, she said, was the woman who started weeping while the preacher, Pastor Chris, was leading the hymn about Christ's love. Weeping so loud, she said, that Pastor Debbie went over and held her. And I started to cry too, right in front of the kids, because I saw the woman without love was me. And then, she said, midway through Pastor Chris's sermon about the loving mansions in the palace of heaven, this old man stood up and began shouting things that scared me at first because they didn't seem to make any sense, until I finally saw it was his need he meant, which felt like my own need, she added, whispering it. And this warmth started in my chest and traveled all the way down to my legs, like thawing out. And I stood up with the others and shouted, Amen. I couldn't help it, Wesley. Amen for the man, and amen for everybody around me in this church out in nowhere, which felt like a loving mansion, too. Longing was what Amy learned when she returned, often by herself, in the months afterward. How if she shut her eyes as Pastor Chris spoke in his sad voice about the thirst for Christ's love, she could almost feel the quenching on her tongue. And how by standing with her hands out and dreaming his sermon about the woman who touched the robe of Jesus, she could sense it on the tips of her fingers, as if she were no longer bound by time, but awake in the reborn self he had promised, leaving the one her mother and Mike had ridiculed far behind. Sometimes, my sister said, she thought she was a little like Jesus, each of them hiding a secret awareness from unbelievers who meant them harm. He, through his parables about new wineskins and fruit trees, she, by telling Mike that God had helped her find her way, and meaning the women at the local shelter she visited on grocery days, lingering afterward beside her favorite field to feed fresh carrots to the horses. For as years passed, and my nieces one by one left home for college, Amy had begun to long for her own life. Meanwhile, just for a little contrast, over to my brother-in-law, Mike. So we go now to part 2, in which Mike discovers Donald Trump as a candidate for president in 2016. So part two, section one. I don't know exactly how Mike responds when he sees Trump for the first time on TV, but I know Mike. How he might laugh at first at the ridiculous fake hair, then, just before clicking to a cop show, get interested in the way Trump keeps calling the runty guy from Florida Little Marco with a sneer, and makes them all seem little, especially the moderators sitting at their desk like teachers with trick questions. Why would Mexico pay for your border wall to keep Mexicans out? Or, what about race relations, their big issue, while the country goes to hell? In a moment like watching the bored, disgusted face of Trump as he turns to take on the moderators too, Mike discovers what he's always known. It's the bullshit rules and the people in charge who make them up that have been holding him and the whole damn country back. Now, when he searches on the television for Trump and finds him wearing a cap over the shock of orange hair that ignited the anger he's carried since childhood, he misses it. And finally, this poem, in which Amy makes her escape. It begins, by the way, with quotations from Trump, which are all carefully researched. The quotations here and throughout the poem are things he actually said. The illegals are taking our jobs, Trump says on the campaign trail in Richmond. They're taking everything, including our money. This is not going to happen anymore. Build the wall. The audience chants, build the wall. My sister Amy does not understand politics. All she thinks about as she starts down the road she's known for 20 years and sees the Trump signs is Mike erupting at the blacks on TV and the hatred in the gun shop and the blessed lightness she feels as she sends it all, sign by sign, into a rearview mirror. Beside her in my mind, holding an imaginary cat crate as she drives toward freedom, I feel the lightness too. Though I worry about the desperation of the stained double-wide and ruined cape we pass, and the backyard with bed springs and refrigerators and a Confederate flag. Not Amy. When I glance over at her, she stares straight ahead, only turning to look at the broad green field she loves, where one of the horses seems to run with us. For after her long struggle, she's living the dream she's dreamed for years. Never mind the closed knitting factory we approach, then send behind us, and the big box stores that replaced Main Street, and the high and different clock of the Bank of America. My sister is lowering the windows and singing the old loving hymn about being lost and found that we once learned in our mother's church. And I, the worrier, the man of little faith, I'm singing it too. That dream of love and home that drives Amy is not hers alone. It begins with the immigrant parents and grandparents in this book who gathered up their children and came here with their original American dream of home. And they passed it on to Amy and me and even my brother-in-law, Mike. And what carried me through the telling of that family story, the writing of it, the telling of it, fitting the generations together and staying true to their dream and their struggle, was the need I felt to take my American story back. Every American president becomes, among other things, the narrator-in-chief of America's story, telling it in any way he wants. But the way Trump has told the story is so corrupted by fear and divisiveness and lies that there's no love in it or hope in it. There's no dream in it. And one wish I have for the readers of this book is that they can use it as a model for taking their own family stories back from the past to the present, telling them to themselves and their families, because their stories, your story and mine, contains the truth of America, never mind this bad turn in our politics. Well, let me close by saying thanks again to Kimberly for having me on her show. And thanks to you also tuning in to hear me read these poems from my new book, just out, called Dwellers in the House of the Lord, which explores the theme of reconciliation in this fraught moment of ours, in which, through this event, we stick together as poets.
That wonderful recording of Wes's reading comes from a few hours north of here, where Wes has lived for many years. Thank you, Wes, for sharing excerpts of your extraordinary book with us. The music you heard there at the end is an original composition by Kent Allen called Emily's Lullaby, performed by Kent. You can buy a copy of Wes's book, Dwellers in the House of the Lord, by calling River Run Bookstore in Portsmouth, New Hampshire at 603-431-2100 or go to the website at riverrunbookstore.com. You can also go to the publisher's website at www.godine.com. Our five community readers, they'll introduce themselves to you now, have selected poems that speak in various ways to Wes's theme for us.
Greetings to everyone. It is good to be with you. My name is Judith Castle. The poem I'm going to read is Robert Frost's Mending Wall. I have loved this poem for a long time, and the Rice Pudding Poetry Series has given me an opportunity to think about why. Stone walls have always been part of my landscape, growing up on the North Sea near the Yorkshire Dales. My siblings and I had a broken-down wall and stile reconstructed in the Dales in memory of our parents. Encountering walls on walks, I think about the men who, in building these walls, brought an orderliness to the landscape which represents a kind of safety. And now here we are, all of us, separated by virtual walls intended to keep us safe. Good virtual fences make healthy neighbours. Yet how amazingly ingenious people have been in finding ways to bridge these walls and to be virtually together, as we are today. Here is Mending Wall. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that sends the frozen groundswell under it and spills the upper boulders in the sun and makes gaps even two can pass abreast. The work of hunters is another thing. I have come after them and made repair where they have left not one stone on a stone, but they would have the rabbit out of hiding to please the yelping dogs. The gaps I mean, no one has seen them made or heard them made, but at spring mending time, we find them there. I let my neighbour know beyond the hill, and on a day we meet to walk the line and set the wall between us once again. We keep the wall between us as we go, to each the boulders that have fallen to each, and some are loaves and some so nearly balls, we have to use a spell to make them balance. Stay where you are until our backs are turned. We wear our fingers rough with handling them. Oh, just another kind of outdoor game, one on a side. It comes to little more. There, where it is, we do not need the wall. He is all pine and I am apple orchard. My apple trees will never get across and eat the cones under his pines, I tell him. He only says, good fences make good neighbours. Spring is the mischief in me, and I wonder if I could put a notion in his head. Why do they make good neighbours? Isn't it where there are cows? But here there are no cows. Before I built a wall, I'd ask to know what I was walling in or walling out, and to whom I was like to give offence. Something there is that doesn't love a wall, that wants it down. I could say elves to him, but it's not elves exactly, and I'd rather he said it for himself. I see him there, bringing a stone grasped firmly by the top, in each hand like an old stone savage armed. He moves in darkness, as it seems to me, not of woods only and the shade of trees. He will not go behind his father's saying, and he likes having thought of it so well, he says it again. Good fences make good neighbors.
Hello, my name is David Frainer. In this virtual rice pudding poetry, I'm taking the liberty of remotely recording The Farmer by Portland, Oregon poet Don Colburn. Our theme is reconciliation and our capacity to transcend the transitory, which is itself a kind of reconciliation. The Farmer. For Ward Sinclair, 1933 to 1995. I've come in now out of the urban rain after a long run through the park, along the horse trail slick with mud. The cloudfall caught me halfway around, as far from home turning back as going on. No thunder, no lightning, just the gray sheen of rain hushing the woods, and reminding me of my friend who threw off his desk job in the city for a truck farm. We envied him, and rose from our desks to tell him when he drove downtown, flatbed loaded with squash, melons, baskets of beans, whatever the earth gave back. But when he shook his head low at the sun and muttered, "Don't know what we're going to do, half an inch of rain since the 1st of May," I knew he really didn't know. Tonight, I picture him out in a field, dancing barefoot in the muck, and hollering everything possible. Thanks for listening.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Hennessy, and I'm going to read a poem called Two Countries by Naomi Shihab Nye. I chose this poem because it is a kind of reconciliation poem with the body, with yourself. Social distancing, like reconciliation, is difficult. Both are constant interruptions, measured displacements, full of risk and arguments you don't want to have, and spaces you want to fill. This poem suggests there is courage and unexpected belonging and understanding in the language of the body. Two Countries by Naomi Shihab Nye. Skin remembers how long the years grow when skin is not touched, a gray tunnel of singleness, feather lost from the tail of a bird swirling onto a step, swept away by someone who never saw it was a feather. Skin ate, walked, slept by itself, knew how to raise a see-you-later hand, but skin felt it was never seen, never known as a land on a map. Nose like a city, hip like a city, gleaming dome of the mosque, and the 100 corridors of cinnamon and rope. Skin had hope. That's what skin does. Heals over the scarred place, makes a road. Love means you breathe in two countries, and skin remembers silk, spiny grass, deep in the pocket that is skin's secret own. Even now, when skin is not alone, it remembers being alone and thanks something larger, that there are travelers, that people go places larger than themselves.
Hello, I'm Patrick Healy. The poem I've chosen to read is called Go All the Way by Charles Bukowski. This poem speaks to me as a visual artist. In order to pursue art, you certainly have to be reconciled to the things that you have to give up along the way to continue your journey in the arts. Go All the Way by Charles Bukowski. If you're going to try, go all the way. Otherwise, don't even start. This could mean losing girlfriends, wives, relatives, and maybe even your mind. It could mean not eating for 3 or 4 days. It could mean freezing on a park bench. It could mean jail. It could mean derision. It could mean mockery, isolation. Isolation is the gift. All the others are a test of your endurance, of how much you really want to do it. And you'll do it, despite rejection and the worst odds. And it will be better than anything else you can imagine. If you're going to try, go all the way. There is no other feeling like that. You will be alone with the gods, and the nights will flame with fire. You will ride life straight to perfect laughter. It's the only good fight there is.
I'm Jody Hetherington, and the poem I chose for this theme of reconciliation is Arabic Coffee by Naomi Shihab Nye. As you may know, she is a Palestinian-American poet. Her father was Palestinian, her mother American, and she grew up very much under the influence of both cultures. This particular poem centers on such a simple act, the making and serving of coffee. Yet the generosity of it feels vast to me, the way it bridges differences between people and cultures, and between disappointment and hope. I'm always very moved by how it so wisely recognizes that every such coming together holds a promise for the future. Arabic coffee. It was never too strong for us. Make it blacker, Papa, thick in the bottom. Tell again how years will gather in small white cups, how luck lives in a spot of grounds. Leaning over the stove, he let it boil to the top and down again, two times, no sugar in his pot. And the place where men and women break off from one another was not present in that room. The 100 disappointments, fire swallowing olive wood beads at the warehouse, and the dreams tucked like pocket handkerchiefs into each day, took their places on the table, near the half-empty dish of corn. And none was more important than the others, and all were guests. When he carried the tray into the room, high and balanced in his hands, it was an offering to all of them. Stay, be seated, follow the talk wherever it goes. The coffee was the center of the flower, like clothes on a line saying, you will live long enough to wear me. A motion of faith. There is this, and there is more.
Thank you.
Kent's elegant close for the community readers is the traditional Scottish tune, The Water is Wide. Thank you to Judith, David, Rebecca, Patrick, and Jody for their beautiful readings. Wes, it's been a great honor to have you with us. Keep safe and well up there in northern Maine. We miss you. Please join us next time, June 4th, for our special guest, Makiel McBride. She'll be joined by community readers Elizabeth Ontelec, Linda Cheatham, Jerry Duffy, Shelley Gardner, Roland Goodbody, and Kathy Wolfe. I'm Kimberly Green, and this edition of Rice Pudding Poetry has been helped along by the great skill and kind patience of production engineer Douglas Green. Thanks again to Kent Allen for his music and to Sophie Green for our rice pudding icon art. Take good care, everyone. Keep vivid in your minds the great gift and blessing of human touch, which comes, for now, in the form of all our voices. It will be good to be together again on June 4th. Bye for now.